Chapter 17, Days of Wine and Impropriety. Supreme Chancellor Thoris Daras was largely responsible for the heady atmosphere that prevailed on Coruscant. A human native of Coralag, Daras had brought a sense of style to the galactic capital that had been absent a decade earlier when Vela Pessivus held the position and hadn't really been seen since the era of Ixis Valorum. Daras was unmarried, an incorrigible womanizer, an enthusiast of sport, opera, legitimate gambling, and high cuisine. His first term of office was characterized by a marked upswing in intemperance and, in the end, rampant corruption. Following the example set by the Supreme Chancellor, many of the tens of thousands who served in the Senate or lobbied on behalf of autocratic corporations and cartels had transformed Coruscant into a den of self-indulgence unrivaled anywhere in the core or inner rim. From all areas of the galaxy had come beings eager to attend to the needs of the new political elite, from chefs to artists to specialists in pleasure. Courtesy of the Trade Federation and its numerous affiliates and corporate partners, goods flooded in from thousands of worlds, giving rise to new fashions, new foods, and novel forms of extravagance. Privileged Coruscanti, determined to enjoy life at the center, turned a blind eye to the storms that were brewing on the edges of civilization. Inter-system rivalries, piratism, organized crime, and spiraling their way toward the core. In 3 years, the planet saw more immigration than it had seen in the preceding 100, primarily from the Outer Rim, whose non-humanoid species arrived in complete ignorance of the hardships that awaited them. For Palpatine, Coruscant exceeded his expectations. 5 years of travel and adventuring in the expansion region and colonies had given him a taste for the high life, and here was a place not simply where his darkest desires could be fulfilled, but also where he could put his unique talents to the test. Its topography of cloud-cutting edifices was a microcosm of the galaxy, swarming with beings who were willing to do whatever was necessary to claw their way from the depths, overseen by a tiered elite that nursed on their misery. If Coruscant was a magnet for those without skills or promise, it was also a paradise for those with credits and connections. And with assistance from many of the scions of wealth Palpatine had met while serving as Naboo's ambassador, along with Higo Damask's coterie of cronies and minions, he felt that he was on his way to the summit of the Senate podium from the moment his boots touched the unnatural ground. He grasped immediately that the only way the Republic might have saved itself was by removing the Senate to a world where temptation wasn't lurking at every traffic nexus, opportunity in every balconied cafe, vice in every canyon. Although the racket that Supreme Chancellor Daras and the Senate had going was obvious only if one knew where to look, and that frequently required having unrestricted access to the private clubs and back rooms to which bribes gravitated. Even without the Force, Palpatine knew he would have succeeded. The task would prove no more challenging than gaining the full confidence of his peers. With everyone striving to outdo one another, he need only ensure that he dress well, dine in the right places, associate with the proper company, and renew his season passes to the galaxy's opera. At the same time, he understood that he could be almost as anonymous as he wished, simply by venturing up or down, dressing up or down, mingling with merchants rather than politicians, or consorting with the hucksters, shysters, con and scam artists that populated the lower levels. His first apartment wasn't luxurious, but it was located in the government district, with room enough for his growing art collection, which now included a costly neranium and bronzium sculpture of the ancient sage Sistros, appropriate for the affluent head of House Palpatine, and containing his original hand-built lightsaber, concealed in a cylindrical cavity undetectable by security scans. The fact that his first official duty as Naboo's interim senator was to attend a funeral, his second that year, seemed only appropriate, given the Sith's eventual plans for Coruscant. Orders to attend Vidar Kim's funeral had come both from Nabu and from Plagueis, who said that he should use the opportunity to seek out Ranhar Kim and speak with him personally. Palpatine had yet to meet one-on-one with the Jedi, and a conversation with Ranhar would allow him to test his ability to conceal his true nature from another Force user. "As wicked as Coruscant is," Plagueis had told him, "the Force is strong there because of the presence of so many Jedi. If you are successful in hiding in plain sight, you will be able to conceal your nature even from the most powerful among them. Take Ranhar into your confidence, and once you have, spend some of your time on Coruscant acquainting yourself with the spired headquarters of our enemy, and ask yourself, is this not a fortress designed to hold the dark at bay?" Otherwise, Plagueis' silence on the matter of Kim's assassination had been deafening. On learning that King Tapelo had appointed Palpatine interim senator, Plagueis offered his congratulations, but nothing more. After months of not seeing him, Palpatine had hoped to find Plagueis waiting for him on Coruscant, but Higo Damask and the Munes, who made up Damask Holdings, were conducting unspecified business on distant Serrano. The funeral service was held at Naboo's embassy, which was located below and to the west of Monument Plaza and the Senate. Dressed in a high-collared cape and purple robes, Palpatine arrived at the ornate monad in the company of Kenman Doriana, Sate Pestage, and Janus Grigiatus, who had been dispatched to Coruscant by Tapelo, and whom Palpatine suspected had some strength in the Force. Kenman and Sate had forged an instant bond. The youthful Doriana was made for a world like Coruscant, and he couldn't have asked for a better guide to the galactic capital's titillating underbelly than Pestage, who seemed to know every nook and cranny of the place. Ranhar Kim was among several dozen guests who were attending the service. Palpatine waited until the Jedi was alone in the viewing room before approaching him. "In concealing yourself, you will not be able to rely on your dark gifts," Plagueis said. "Instead, you must be yourself, submerged in the unified pattern to which the Jedi are attuned, visible in the Force, but not as a Sith. Since you cannot allow yourself to be seen, you must make certain that you are taken for granted. Disguised in the profane, camouflaged in the routine, in those same realms from which you can attack without warning when necessary." A tall, muscular young man attired in black robes, Ranhar had thick black hair pulled into a bun behind, and with long strands in front dangling from temples to chin. In him, Palpatine could see Vidar, whose body was lying in state, supine on a massive, rectangular stone bier. A simple blanket covered the corpse from shoulders to knees, and on the chest sat a shallow, metallic bowl containing purple flowers and a lighted candle meant to symbolize the Livid Tower's eternal flame. Janus Grigiatus would transport the cremation ashes to Naboo, where they would be scattered in the Soliu River. "Jedi Ranhar Kim," Palpatine said as he entered the room, "please forgive the intrusion, but I wanted to offer my condolences in person." Roused from his thoughts, Ranhar whirled on him, almost in defense, and scanned him from head to toe. "Who are you?" "Palpatine," he said. "I've been appointed to succeed Vidar Kim as Senator of Naboo. I knew your father well." Ranhar's vigilance eased. "Forgive me for not knowing more about Naboo, Senator Palpatine. But in fact, until several weeks ago, I wasn't aware that Vidar Kim was my biological father, or even that Naboo was my homeworld." Palpatine feigned understanding. "No need to apologize. I imagine that the Force is, in some sense, its own domain." Ranhar nodded. "I scarcely knew the man. Were it not for the fact that he was a Republic senator, the Jedi Council would not have granted dispensation for me to meet with him." Palpatine allowed himself to stretch out with the Force, but only for a moment, and chiefly to gauge the Jedi's reaction, which proved to be indiscernible. "Excuse me for asking, but Why then did you choose to attend the service? Ranha grew pensive. No doubt you know about the tragedy that claimed the lives of his wife and sons. I do. Vidar Kim contacted me to ask if I would consider renouncing my pledge to the Jedi in order to become the bearer of the family name. Palpatine moved closer to him and added compassion to his voice. He told me, Ranha. Does your presence here reflect doubt as to your obligations? No, the Jedi said, perhaps more firmly than he intended. I'm only here out of respect for the man. As you may also know, he died at the hands of an assassin while in my company. Ranha's voice betrayed disappointment rather than anger. If I had acted sooner, he would be alive. And at present, I can't be certain that the assassin's blaster bolts weren't meant for me rather than Vidar Kim. Who in their right mind would target a Jedi Knight? The Jedi sniffed and narrowed his dark eyes. The Jedi do not lack for enemies, Senator. Doling out justice and ensuring the peace doesn't sit well with some beings. The world of politics is no safer, Ranha. Not in this era, with so many in need. Thank the Force we have the Jedi. I wonder, Kim said. Palpatine regarded him with interest. The Jedi was less interested in solving the murder of Vidar than he was in agonizing over his failure to prevent it. You wonder about what, Ranha? What my life might have been had I not become a Jedi. Palpatine adopted a look of shock. The choice was not yours to make. You have the Force. Your destiny was a foregone conclusion. Ranha mulled it over. And if Vidar Kim had elected not to surrender me to the Order? A line of thought impossible to follow to any conclusion, Palpatine said. The Jedi looked at him and squared his shoulders. There are many forks in the path, Senator. Had I remained on Naboo, I might have followed in Vidar Kim's footsteps and entered politics. Perhaps it's not too late. Palpatine showed him a tolerant smile and came alongside him, confident now that his true nature was beyond detection. I have to admit that the notion of a politician with Jedi values is not without its appeal. In fact, the Republic was once overseen by Jedi chancellors only. But I'm afraid you're something of an anachronism, Ranha. The galaxy appears to have rejected the idea of enlightened leadership. The best politician presently is merely exceptional, where every Jedi is extraordinary. Ranha laughed shortly. More and more, Senator Palpatine, you begin to sound like my former master. Would that I had such talents, Palpatine said, making light of it. But I do have a proposition, Ranha. Not only am I new to the Senate, I'm new to Coruscant, and it would be good to have someone to count on as a friend. So what would you say to an alliance between a politician and a Jedi? Through me, you could gain insight into the workings of the Republic, and through you, I might better understand the Jedi in their roles as peacekeepers. Ranha inclined his head in a bow. I respect Vidar Kim all the more for bringing us together. May the Force be with you, Senator Palpatine. On Sereno, remote from the core along the Hydean Way, a female servant of Count Vimek, costumed in garb from an era long past, escorted the quartet of human Jedi into the castle's expensively modernized conference room. First to be introduced to those assembled, including dignitaries and politicians representing Sereno and nearby Salonan and the Mune Corps of Damask Holdings, was Jedi Master and Council Member Jocasta Nu, a pleasant-looking woman with straight hair, pronounced cheekbones, and brilliant blue eyes. Accompanying her were distinguished Jedi Masters Dooku and Sifo Dyas, and a tall, powerfully built Jedi Knight named Qui-Gon Jinn, who remained standing while the rest took their designated seats at the circular table. The three men carried themselves with palpable self-assurance and affected beards of different styles. Dooku's terminated in a stylish point. Sifo Dyas's followed his strong jawline. Qui-Gon's was long and thick. Plagueis, who rarely missed an opportunity to interact with Jedi, had planned to leave the business on Sereno to Larsh Hill and the others, until learning that Dooku would be present. 50 or so standard years old, Dooku was Sereno's native son, hailing from a noble lineage analogous to the Naboo Palpatines. Had he not been born strong in the Force, he would have been a count, in the same way that Palpatine would have been a royal. But on the few occasions Plagueis had encountered Dooku, he had sensed something in him that warranted further investigation. Dooku was said to be one of the Order's finest lightsaber masters, and he had earned a reputation as a skilled diplomat as well. But his passion and restlessness were what had captured Plagueis's attention. For all his decades in the Order, he seemed to have kept one foot anchored in the mundane. In place of the homespun brown robes worn by most Jedi, like the hail Qui-Gon Jinn, Dooku favored cloaks and robes more appropriate to a night at the opera on Coruscant. In addition, he was a candid critic of Supreme Chancellor Darris and the corrupt practices of the Senate. Most important, perhaps, Dooku was linked to the Sith's grand plan in ways that went beyond circumstantial. Some 20 years earlier, in a scheme engineered by Tenebris to replace human Senator Blix Anon with a young upstart named Eero Iridian, Dooku and his then Padawan Qui-Gon Jinn were caught up in the events and had managed to send some of the principal players to prison. Dooku had also unwittingly sabotaged several of Tenebris's plans to foster intersystem dissent in the expansion region. In the aftermath of the near-disastrous assassination of Vidar Kim, Plagueis's interest in Dooku had assumed a new urgency. He felt certain that Sidious would evolve into a commanding Sith, but just now the young Naboo was drunk with power and prone to make mistakes. When the dark recognized one as a true ally, a novice could lose his or her way, as had almost happened to Plagueis following the murder of Carid Sanfe. Bane-adoring Sith masters like Tenebris might have used the meeting on Sereno as a means of threatening their apprentices with replacement. Plagueis, however, had no such intention, which was why he hadn't mentioned to Sidious that Jedi would be attending the meeting. Even so, he found himself wondering whether a dissatisfied Jedi like Dooku could be insurance against a reversal of fortune, some unexpected event that would rob him of Sidious, or perhaps turn to the dark without formal enlistment and manipulated into instigating a schism in the Order. As he had told Sidious, even a trained Jedi could succumb to the lure of the dark side on his or her own. 130 years earlier, on a former Sith world in the Kalaran system, a Padawan named Kibi-Jin had been so strongly affected by the lingering power in a fortress on Almas that he submitted himself to the dark side and initiated a system-wide conflict. Perhaps under Plagueis's influence, Master Dooku could be inspired to do something similar. The Jedi would bear closer observation. One of Selenon's legal advocates was the first to speak when everyone had been seated.
Selenon protests the presence of Jedi Master Dooku at this meeting, since it has come to our attention that he is Serenian by birth.
Sereno's arrogant Count Vimax started to respond when Dooku cut him off, addressing himself to the litigator.
If you had investigated further, you would also know that I renounced all ties to my family and Sereno on being accepted into the Jedi Order.
He turned his penetrating gaze on Salonon's ambassador.
I assure you that I will be as impartial as any one of you.
Salonon's ambassador, a large, bumptious human, cleared his throat in a meaningful way.
Jedi Master Dooku's reputation for even-handedness precedes him. We trust that he will be as fair in this matter as he is known to have been elsewhere. With that issue behind us, Vimek said, I call for an official start to these proceedings.
The issue at hand involved the planned construction of an Aqualish manufactured hyperwave repeater in Salonon space that would expand the reach of the HoloNet well into the corporate sector, a vast region of the Tingle Arm that had become an economic playground for the banking clan and the corporate alliance, through lucrative deals brokered by Damask Holdings. In compensation for the fact that placement of the repeater would necessitate changes in hyperspace trade routes, Salonon had announced that ships entering Salonon space from the systems of the Upper Hydean would be required to pay substantial transit taxes. Plagueis had limited interest in the debate. Secretly, he hoped that mediation would fail. Citing controversy, Damask Holdings could then withdraw and the project would collapse, leaving systems in the Tingle Arm fuming over having been victimized by a foolish squabble between two wealthy Republic worlds. After 4 hours of pointless back and forth, Plagueis began to feel like the victimized one. When Count Vimic finally called a break in the proceedings, and many of the participants headed to the food tables, Plagueis found himself alone with Dooku, Sifo Dyas, and Qui-Gon Jinn, and drew the cloak of the profane over himself. "Bickering is becoming all too common," he remarked to no one in particular. "In the absence of resolution, it will be the outlying systems that will suffer most." Dooku nodded sagely.
"The hyperwave repeater should have been a Republic undertaking. The Senate erred in allowing the HoloNet to be privatized."
Qui-Gon Jinn's ears pricked up, and he glanced at Plagueis.
"Discontent in the outer systems is in keeping with the aims of Damask Holdings, is it not, Magister?"
"On the contrary," Plagueis replied in a composed voice. "We advocate for the interests of neglected worlds when and wherever we can."
The tall Jedi wasn't persuaded to back off.
"By supporting the likes of the Trade Federation and other cartels."
"The Trade Federation has brought progress to many a backward world, Master Jinn.
Through exploitation that leads ultimately to ruin."
Plagueis spread his hands. "Progress often comes at a cost. On occasion, a world will go through growth pangs as a result, but to call the end result ruination is overstating the case."
He studied Qui-Gon.
"Surely the Jedi have had to ignore consequences of the same magnitude in enforcing the laws of the Republic."
Sifo Dyas's dark brows formed a V. A short, muscular man, he had a broad nose, prominent cheekbones, and lustrous black hair cinched in a high topknot. His hands were large and calloused, as if from physical labor. Concern shone in his brown eyes.
"It is a misconception that we serve only the Republic, Magister. Our order serves the greater good."
"As the order defines it," Plagueis said, only to wave the remark away. "But then you have the advantage of being able to act in concert with the Force, where the rest of us are left to grope in the dark for what is just and right. Damask Holdings tries, nonetheless, to take the long view."
"As do the Jedi," Qui-Gon said.
"But in several instances where we have had to resolve conflicts, it is your name that has surfaced."
Plagueis shrugged.
"The wealthy are held to higher standards than the poor."
Dooku thought about it.
"I blame the Senate for encouraging the galaxy to turn on credit."
Plagueis glanced from Dooku to Qui-Gon.
"I'm willing to concede Master Jinn's point that the Munes have cornered the market on finance, if he is willing to concede that the Jedi have cornered the market on ethics."
Qui-Gon granted Plagueis a dignified bow.
"And so we find ourselves on different sides, Magister." "Not necessarily. Perhaps we are after the same thing."
"Different paths to the same destination. It's a clever rationalization, but I refuse to accept it."
Qui-Gon placed his hands in the opposite sleeves of his robe.
"If you'll excuse me."
Dooku smiled lightly as the tall Jedi sauntered off.
"My former apprentice, does not mince words. Frank talk is a rarity these days, Plagueis said. The Senate could learn from beings like Qui-Gon Jinn. Dooku made a glum face. The Senate listens only to itself. Endlessly, and without purpose. If it and Supreme Chancellor Darus are going to perpetuate a climate where injustice can advance, then it will.
Sifo Dyas grew uneasy. The Rotunda is an arena even we don't enter, he said in a level voice. Except as spectators. Plagueis could not restrain a smile.
But you have, from time to time, been known to lobby.
He continued before Sifo Dyas or Dooku could answer.
It can be a circus. One thing is certain, however. The core is not holding. New leadership is needed. Darus will undoubtedly be elected to another term, Dooku said.
Plagueis pretended concern.
Is there no one who can defeat him, Master Dooku? Frix, possibly. Kalpana, eventually. At present, he isn't strong enough to overcome the special interest lobbies.
Sifo Dyas's unease increased. We are sworn not to take an active role in any case.
Kalpana would certainly set a different tone, Plagueis said. But perhaps an equally risky one. His stance against piratism, smuggling, even slavery is well known. Unfortunately, many of the outer systems survive only because of such practices.
Then those worlds will have to find alternative means, Sifo Dyas said. Plagueis turned to him.
Without assistance from the Republic? It begins to sound to me as if the Jedi will have their work cut out for them.
Sifo Dyas compressed his lips. The Judicials and the Jedi will maintain peace.
There's certainty in your voice, Plagueis said. But let me pose a question. If discontent spreads, and intersystem conflict breaks out, if member worlds threaten secession, as Serrano threatened in times past, would your loyalties not be divided?
The Republic will be preserved, Plagueis grinned.
Again, that comforting confidence. But suppose the Republic's goals were not in keeping with the greater good. Suppose conflict grew to become actual schism.
The two Jedi traded looks.
In the absence of armies, there can be no war, Dooku said. Are the Jedi not an army? Or at least capable of becoming one should the need arise?
We were an army at one time. But our enemies were vanquished, Sifo Dyas said with deliberate vagueness. No matter the extent of the conflict, we would attempt to forge a peace, and without becoming the ruling body you seem to fear. Plagueis didn't reply immediately. Sifo Dyas was proving to be even more interesting than Dooku, though in a different way. Only a misguided sense of loyalty to the Jedi Order kept him from giving voice to the real extent of his apprehensions.
And yet you say, forge a peace. That has the ring of semantics to it, Master Sifo Dyas. But for the sake of argument, what if the disaffected systems raised an army? Wouldn't the Jedi be obligated to serve and protect the Republic?
Sifo Dyas forced an exhale. From where would these hypothetical armies arise? The outlying systems lack the resources. Realizing his error, he trailed off. Plagueis waited a moment, his satisfaction concealed.
I didn't mean to suggest that the Republic is purposely depriving the outlying systems of the right to self-determination. I'm merely speculating because I do see a growing threat.
Dooku regarded him.
You are not alone in seeing it, Magister.
Then one final question, if I may. If attacked, would you counterattack?
The Republic has pledged to remain demilitarized, Dooku said. It would militarize only in the instance of a perceived threat.
Once more, you've reframed your initial question, Magister Damask, Sifo Dyas interrupted, a new fire in his eyes.
You're hypothesizing an attack on the Jedi Order itself.
I suppose I am, Plagueis said self-deprecatingly. I suppose I was thinking of the recent assassination of Senator Vidar Kim. A Jedi was involved, if I'm not mistaken.
That matter is being looked into, Sifo Dyas said in a controlled voice. There's no evidence to suggest that the Jedi in question was targeted.
The silence that followed was broken by the voice of Jocasta Nu, who was summoning the Jedi to the far side of the conference room. Plagueis studied Sifo Dyas peripherally. While Nu and the others conferred, he thought back to the conversation he'd had with Sidious on Sojourn.
We will have to exploit their self-righteousness and blind obedience to the Republic, Sidious had said at one point. The Jedi must be made to appear the enemies of peace and justice, rather than the guardians.
Mulling it over anew, Plagueis began to wonder whether he had taken the wrong approach on Kamino. Perhaps, he thought, it would be better to have the Kaminoans create an army capable of fighting alongside the Jedi, rather than against them. Sifo Dyas was the first to return to Plagueis's corner of the room, as if eager to continue the conversation.
Lest you're thinking of investing in military enterprises, Magister, I can assure you that the Republic will not reverse its stance on demilitarization.
His words were forceful but lacked certainty.
The Rusan reformations will not be repealed.
Plagueis showed the palms of his hands.
And I can assure you, Master Jedi, that my questions were in no means motivated by thoughts of profit. I don't wish to see the Republic caught off guard. For now, I'll place my faith in the Jedi, and in the belief that an army could be raised if necessary.
Sifo Dyas's gaze faltered.
Out of thin air? Unlikely, Magister.
Grown, then.
Manufactured, you mean?
No, I was being literal, Plagueis said. But I know of only one group that might be up to the task. The group who grew laborers to work the mines of Subterral.
Puzzlement wrinkled Sifo Dyas's face.
I'm not familiar with Subterral.
Plagueis was about to mention Kamino when he spied Jocasta Nu approaching, and a feeling from deep in the dark side rose up inside him, strangling his voice box, as if refusing to let the word escape.
I apologize, Master Jedi, he said when he could. The name of the group was on the tip of my tongue, but I seem to have swallowed it.